This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on remote with Jody Boltz, who is the author of The Near and Far. Jody, hello.
Hello.
We were supposed to be sitting across a table from each other at the beautiful Library of Congress.
Well, this is the far. That would have been the near.
But here, yes, here we are at separate tables.
Right.
But your voice is what we wanted, and your voice is what we're going to get. So let's hear an opening poem.
Okay. This poem is called The House Itself. Easy to believe this house belonged to strangers before it was ours, but impossible to picture strangers living here again, waking in this room and stepping to the window to gaze out at the green. A view less open years from now, the red buds and native oaks we planted as saplings, grown tall by then, grown wide. How quickly it happens. You find a home to settle in, meet neighbors and restore the porch, pull wild vines from every bush, cut ivy from the trees. You jack and shim the sagging floor in back of the living room, repaint the walls, repair the garage. You buy an old farm table, hampers, mirrors, chairs. And soon the place is yours, its stairs and shadows, the doorway of each room, your clothes in the closets, your books on the shelves, your fire and your darkness, your infant in your arms.
The voice of Jody Boltz. The book is The Near and Far. And what I love the most is that there is always someone off stage, an indirect characterization in all of your work. So there's a central speaker, and there's always a shadow. There's always a backdrop. There's always a locus, a place. So Jody, I have said your work is crystalline and translucent. Do you know what I mean by that?
I would love to know what you mean, because I so much want that to be true.
Well, the delicacy and the strength, and I've said this I guess you wish I would find some more adjectives. I've said this for 30 years about you. And so what is it? It's your diction. It is your word choice. And that's what we're going to be looking for the whole program and listening for. What is it that you do? How do you go from stanza to stanza? How do you keep the energy, but most of all, the choice of words, Jody? It is as if you've rinsed off every one of them. So let's see if I'm right or not.
All right, let's see.
Let's have two so the audience can hear a little bit more of you.
Okay. The next
one. Oh, first of all, before we do that, let me say, I think we should let them know what the book is about.
Okay, great. All right. So I have become... I'm not troubled by this. I'm sort of exhilarated by it, but I may have become a recidivist in the book-length poem writing world. This is my third book-length poetry collection, in the sense that, you know, it's a sequence of poems that go together. In any case, the book is centered on our house itself, which we've lived in for more than 30 years. I started writing the poems when I realized we'd been here 30 years. Mm. And I think maybe, like many women poets, the domestic world is something that, as totally vivid and meaningful as it is to oneself, one worries that it won't be of interest to others. And it's really interesting to me that though this book came out before we were all stuck in our homes, it seems to be a universal kind of perception that the home is more than a place.
Yes, let us hear some poems.
Okay. All right, so the next poem is called Threshold. When the house was first ours, before it smelled of paint and wax, before we laid down rugs or cooked a single meal in its small outmoded kitchen, it had the stony scent of shade under a garden shed, the damp, unsettled smell of quiet and disuse. Though it hadn't stood empty. We'd open the back door and there it was, intractable as loneliness, or the memory of loneliness, as if someone else's loss were lodged within our gain. And it seems important now, that before we moved in, the house smelled stony and shadowed, even in the light of a mild November, as we crossed the threshold 10, 12, 20 times with tools and tiles and cleaning supplies, each bright room blank, the walls and windows bare, steps uncarpeted, floorboards scarred. But how sure I felt, how safe, as if the history of this place had always been leading to the home we'd make, the home we were making that weirdly balmy fall, when a life seemed long.
Jody Bolts, The Near and Far. Before we go to the next poem, I just want to focus one thing, and that is, I'm trying to get in touch with what I feel about your work, and it is vivid that you use hard materials. You use mortar, you use furniture, you use hearth, you use real tangible things, but you change them to consciousness so that all these articles become sheer consciousness. And that is a kind of miracle. That's a kind of alchemy. I want to keep thinking of this as I hear your next poem. So let's have it.
Okay. Oh, I'm very interested in that. I want to
talk
to you about
that. We might have a chance on or off this remote because it is true.
There's a lot of architecture. It's interesting you talk about hard materials or, you know, material things.
But what do they add up to? What they do is become...
Yeah, it's all pretty specter-like or ghost-like or dream-like about time. I'm always
obviously
interested in time.
And you also change everything to essence. So let us see the next poem.
All right. Passage. The upstairs hall is narrow, 5 strides long and 1 across. 3 rooms so close together that the children could call us from their beds if they were sick or scared. They didn't have to shout. The 4 of us were clustered in the roof line of the house. So we thought the kids felt safe. At least they never had to brave a long dark corridor to find us. And for years we lived that way, within reach of one another. Each bedroom ceiling streaked with a stanza of deflected light. Easy then to feel at home, the place adrift in picture books and puppets, toy animals in cheerful clothes, ragtag collections of marbles, fur cones, feathers, the local world's offerings of signs and wonders, antique bottles unearthed in the ravine, white stones round as starry moons, objects of enchantment. And weren't we enchanted? Though tired and worried, thwarted, sometimes grieving, both our fathers sick and dying in those years we thought would last, but couldn't last. Of course not. A home like that, only for children to grow up in and then leave, crossing the narrow hall away from us.
Within reach of one another, within reach of one another. That is the silver thread that goes throughout this book. And it is a book that I think will become a cornerstone, not only for women, but because of where poetry has come from the 40s, when domesticity was introduced into poetry with maybe Elizabeth Bishop and then Anne Sexton and better known Maxine Cumin. But what you do is take artifacts and change them to something else. And that is tone. That is tone. And that is why your poetry has been distinctive for years among poets.
Thank you, Grace. You know, one thing I want to tell you about this, I was concerned. Okay, I wrote the last poem that I'm going to read during our conversation, which is the title poem, The Near and Far.
Oh, say that title first, again.
The Near and Far, it's the title poem. And as with all of my other book-length sequences, I wrote what ended up being the last part of the book first, And I couldn't stop. I mean, there was a whole world that somehow had opened to me, and I realized it wasn't one poem that I was going to try to place, but, you know, more than that. In any case, one thing that I was worried about was the comfort level of the sort of off, as you say, offstage, whatever, this sort of spectral speaker of the poems who's looking at this life, looking back at this life in this home, being comfortably middle class and having a home that was, you know, safe and enough to eat, enough to, you know, being.
And why was that a worry?
A privilege.
What was the worry about that?
That's who I am, so it didn't worry me in the sense of feeling guilty about it, but I wasn't sure it would be universal. So this amazing thing happened. When I was first writing these poems 5 or 6 years ago, I was giving a reading here in Washington, and I read 2 or 3 of them. And a woman whom I knew a little bit came up to me afterwards, a poet, and said she loved the work. She really, would I send her the poems from this new series I was writing so she could use them in her class? And another friend had used some in her class. She was teaching graduate school. And I thought, wow, that's something. And I said, sure. So I sent her the poems. And in the email, I said, remind me where you teach. And she said, Miriam's Kitchen. And which I always get mixed up with Martha's Table. But anyway, they're both homeless shelters. She was teaching a class in creative writing at a homeless shelter. And I said, oh, I'm so worried that these poems will be offensive to them. And she said, I will report back. And, you know, no, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with her teaching. But it ended up being the most successful assignment that she'd given, because every person in her class had not only sensory relationship to the idea of home, but an ideal of home.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. It is the ideal that you're touching, and you're not saying, this is my wonderful, privileged house. You're saying, this is what a hearth is. This is what a hearth is. It's a heart, which is a home.
Oh.
And I want to tell them who you are before we hear the next piece.
Okay, fine.
And that is Jodi. Not only has this book, but she also is the author of A Lesson in Narrative Time, which was a novella in verse, no small thing. And many of her poems have been in literary journals, The American Scholar, Indiana Review, North American Review, Plowshares, Poetry East, Poetry Northwest, Southern Poetry Review. The poets listening will know they are classy. The rest will just know that you've been published. And so you're right up there. You've also been the editor of Poet Lore, which we will talk about later, for some 17 years going. And that is America's oldest poetry magazine. So let us go on to the next poem.
Okay.
And see what the house means to us.
This one is called Stormwatch. So we're moving out onto the porch now. Mm. Get a little fresh air. Stormwatch. Were we on the porch already? The baby in her playpen, boy careening from the hammock to the rocking chair and back? Or did we rush out when the storm began, wanting to be almost in it, outside but still sheltered, thunder thudding through our ribs? The kids spellbound and abstracted, never crying to be held. The downpour only yards away, cold spray of spring rain in our hair and on our faces. There was nothing for those minutes but the green world's shudder and the sky split silver over our magnolia tree, which swooned and beckoned, water pooling at its roots, then rushing to the street. The neighbors' houses indistinct, though maybe they were home too, standing by the windows, looking out at the four of us, a family in a shadow box that gleamed and dimmed and gleamed again before it went dark.
Whoa. Wow. What is sequence poetry, Jodi?
It's so interesting how your curiosity about something can just get out of control.
Oh, that's it, huh? So it's just nothing but pure obsession.
Right.
Well, the thing about your work is that there's no regret. in the past. And that is what stuns me the most, that you can recall it. We know you felt everything every human being has felt, but I do not feel regret. And so there's just a luminosity about this where you've taken it, you've burned it pure. You've burned it pure.
Oh, wow.
But tell me what a sequence is. I've written books, as you know, with characters.
Of course.
Every poem has a character about Mary Wollstonecraft or Anna Nicole Smith. Right. Why aren't they sequence poems?
Well, books have all sorts of ways. The poems within a collection can connect to each other in all sorts of ways.
Like themes.
But yes, by theme, by form, like, you know, crowns of sonnets or sonnet sequences of other kinds.
Right.
You know, and so there's sometimes narrative. For example, Shadow Play, the novella in verse, had a narrative through line, but also another through line, which had to do with an imagined conversation that interrupted the narrative. That was my second book. The first book I wrote, it was The Hours of the Day, which, you know, obviously James Joyce and others have done a work of literature that is covering one day. But if you think of all of the book-length sequences in many cultures, but starting with the Gilgamesh, the Iliad, the Odyssey, you know, you have the Divine Comedy, those are great, big, epic journeys that are really long poems.
Well, did you set out to say, I am going to, in the near and far, I am going to start here and in there?
I'm a very organized person in my personal life, but when it comes to poetry, I just go where it leads me. I had no idea.
Well, why is it a sequence?
Okay, it's a sequence because there's a layering of understanding about what it means to spend time in a place, in a domestic life, that accumulates. Though each poem was published separately in journals or together, you know, sometimes two or three were together in a journal, the poems all stand alone. So in that sense, they're not dependent upon one another. But in sequence, the 20 poems create something different from a collection. I think that's really what I would say.
Well, do you have a longer poem that is something that we can see how you keep the energy afloat?
Yes. Now, I was going to read it last, but I'm happy to read it now.
Is this Threshold?
No. That Threshold was the shorter one that I just read. But the Near and Far, the title poem, is long. This one is long enough to build some sort of narrative.
Yeah, I want to see what momentum.
Okay.
I want to see how you use language so that it doesn't fall, how you don't puncture language. Because a long piece is very ambitious and it takes different things. You have to do different tricky things with it to keep it afloat.
That's
so
true.
So let's hear if you do.
Okay, well, this isn't too long, but it's long enough to build some momentum. Okay.
Okay.
This is called Evening.
And you are Jody Bowles.
I am Jody Bowles. Still, even now. Evening. Most days I cooked without gratitude, standing at the kitchen counter, rinsing and chopping and checking the clock at 5:50, 6:15. The violets on our windowsill, backlit by sunset, are outlined in winter dark. As I place pots to simmer over wide blue flames, stirring, tasting, seasoning our food. There was never any question of whether or when or what we might eat. We had everything we needed, and the fact seemed commonplace. Our comfort, commonplace. Each evening a steep course to master task by task. Scouring the cutting board, sponging the stovetop, talking to the children as they leaned over their worksheets, looking up from time to time to spar with one another, or leaping to the door to let the cats back in. While I watched the hour pass beyond a wall of windows, seasons in free fall, like the pages of a flip book, green and gold and gone. Sometimes, when it snowed, the kids would drop their pencils to race outside, but I didn't join them. I was barreling downhill in the midst of all that beauty, veering through each gate to be done and done and done. Another weekday evening vanishing beneath me, and now the level ground flung wide.
Jody, we had everything we needed. We had everything we needed.
Yeah.
Why is it that you turn everything into something that we can hope for? It's almost like making a future memory. I thought that the background was a playground for tears, really. And I don't feel the tears, but I feel loss. Now explain to me how you did this. I feel loss, and yet I don't feel sorrow.
Oh, no, that's a very
how
perceptive.
How did you do that? Okay. What did you do?
I think it's very hard to, it's very hard to see things clearly while you're in them, which is why I think people are having trouble. Some people, I mean, a lot of us might want to write about this moment we're in during the pandemic because we're experiencing something very important, but we're in it, you know? And I think one thing about a 30-year, you look back at your life in a home over the course of 30 years, and what you're able to discern is different from what you were seeing at the moment.
I see.
Yeah.
That answers my question, truly.
Yeah.
It is perspective that has actually cleared it up a bit.
And mortality's greater presence as we age, you know?
Well, I think that this book is going to gain more acclaim as it lasts, because I think this is a kind of poetry that you keep discovering, that you keep discovering. And I think that this, I hope that so many people that hear this will want to see this on the page, because it is a lesson in writing, the way it is placed. The aesthetics on the page are extremely important, people. Make it pretty on the page, I always say.
That's right, that's right.
Well, what did you learn as you were editor of Poet Lore, which you'll have to describe quickly before we go back to poetry. Describe what this magazine was and its heft, but mostly what did you learn about yourself?
Oh, it was such a wonderful, that 17-year period of editing this magazine, which was the oldest poetry journal, 131 years old in America. That period of time was so rich and remarkable. Ethelbert Miller and I did this. We were the executive editors together. And what was amazing was to hear, I mean, to be Whitman-esque, to hear America singing, and sometimes people from outside America, but the number of poems we read, more than 1,000 a month, with great care, gave us such a sense of what was going on among poets in this country. And then selecting them and organizing them so they spoke to one another, and always having some thematic thread that we discussed that had a historical import. What we really felt is that poetry, and as you've said in other language, you know, poetry is a record of felt life. I think you once called it a ribbon of song, you know, and it keeps being new when you read it.
Okay, but Jody, this is a great contribution to humankind that you have done, and it was a sacrifice also. Believe me, I've seen those stacks of submissions. However, what did you find out about your own poetry after reading hundreds and hundreds of poems?
I think probably in the years before I edited Poet Lore, though I was teaching college, so I certainly saw a lot of writing by other people daily, I always thought it was strange that my work was never trending. Even when I was in graduate school, I remember having another graduate student at Cornell say, "Jody Bowles, this work is beautiful, but so what?" So it was the 70s, you know, it was the early 70s, and it was like, why are you writing in this way, this crystalline way, you know? But anyway, I think I really found out that what I was seeking as an editor had nothing to do with my own style. What it had to do with was mystery and strangeness and layered consciousness. So,
oh, yes.
You know, and by strangeness, I don't mean weird. I mean, you know you're in the presence of something strange that makes you want to read it over and over again and share it because you don't quite get it. I heard a podcast recently about, it was actually about intelligence gathering. So it had nothing to do with poetry, but it talked about the difference between a mystery and a secret. And a mystery is something that maybe can't be discovered.
I love that very much.
But a secret is something somebody is, you know, keeping
but
from you.
That's a very good segue, because your poetry is mysterious, because we keep opening doors and getting deeper. And if you read the same poem more than once, you go someplace else in the same room.
Well, I hope that's true. I really do.
So I would like everyone to know also that you know what you're doing, because you taught for more than 20 years at George Washington University and headed the creative writing program. So you saw a lot of stuff.
I only headed it for a few years. I mean, now and then. Others were sort of the real heads, and I was filling in, but it was a wonderful experience. It was such a wonderful experience.
But you saw a lot of stuff coming in, some good, some bad.
And some of my students, you know, are doing so well, have published in places I haven't yet, like the New Yorker.
Well, Jody, let us have a final poem.
Okay. This is one of my favorite poems in the book, and it shows you that we're not very energy efficient. Okay. Tableau. For beauty, not for heat, we built fires all winter. The small square of our hearth, an altar or a theater. But what were we witnessing, beguiled by the smell and sound? The walls of the living room billowing around our gold and shadowed figures, image of a family from another age. The firelight itself unfixed in time, unfixed in place, general as the dark and cold, as hunger and danger. Though we were warm and safe, furnace humming, radiators hot to the touch, our kitchen stocked, mere steps from where we sat, talking or reading or listening to music. And sometimes the phone rang, or the cats cried to go out. We rarely sat in silence. But imagining it now, the only sound is the bright pulse of the fire, not the pop and hiss of burning, just the airy errant thrumming of the flames.
Jody Bolts, I love you, and I love this book, The Near and the Far. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on Remote. Our program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.